Good Friday morning. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. I'm Renee Bodley, filling in for Leslie Thatcher, who's on vacation this week. Looks like a beautiful morning out there. While we wait for our weather report to call in, why don't we talk about trails? Here's Charlie Sturgis. Good morning, Charlie.
Good morning, Renee.
How's it looking out there for the weekend?
You know, it's unbelievable. The rain has helped a lot. Anyone who's been out in the trails recently can tell that dust is settling down some, so that's super cool. So let's get right into event world for us, because this is kind of our last big weekend. We will be, Clay Carrs and myself will be out actually setting course in Round Valley for the Round Valley Half Marathon tomorrow, that is going tomorrow. And that is actually part of a co-partnering with Mountain Trails and the Salt Lake Running Company to actually put that event on. It's the third stage of our Triple Trail Challenge. So we are also involved in that event tomorrow. So you will see traffic or a lot of runners between 8 and 11:30, something like that. Tour de Suds, 33rd running of the Tour de Suds is coming up here on Sunday. Looks like we're going to have a brilliant day. Skull Candy's all queued up for the party at the top. They're the main sponsor.
What's the route of Tour de Suds?
Basically it's from City Park. So everybody starts at City Park and goes all the way up to Empire Pass. 2,700 verticals, 7 miles, and generally follows the old Tour de Suds. But it goes up Main Street, past the Water Tower, up Daly Canyon, jumps on the single track. Single track goes up Tour de Suds for most of the way, up into the Flagstaff Loop and to the finish. So come prepared to have fun. It's a costume type of event. And, of course, burgers and libations and so forth are at the Townlift Plaza afterwards. So as soon as you finish the race and ready to turn down, come on down and we'll get you fed and refreshed.
And Round Valley, if we want to go out and walk our dogs in Round Valley tomorrow morning, what should we avoid because of that marathon?
Most of the Round Valley area.
Ah, really? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's 13 miles, so it's not everything. The race won't start until 8, and most everyone should be done pretty much by 11. Probably if you're walking your dogs, that's, when you got a lot of runners and dogs that are easily sidetracked, maybe it's better to walk them someplace else for that morning, or maybe be a little bit more leash aware. Just a lot of runners can probably get a dog excited unknowingly, and you might want to be just a little bit more on task. So, anyways, it shouldn't be a big deal, but, just be aware of it.
Okay. Charlie Sturgis with our Trails Report. Thanks for being here this morning.
Oh, you bet, Renee.
The Local News Hour on KPCW. The Treasure Hill development debate hit the dirt this week with an on-site tour for the public. The City Planning Commission, staff, and developers showed the public around the property. About 100 people were there, with Pat Sweeney pointing out stakes designating certain building sites. The entire development would cover 1 million square feet above Old Town in the Creole Gulch area that's around Town Lift. After the tour, they proceeded to the Jim Santee Auditorium for the Planning Commission meeting to continue their work on the project. Joining me this morning is Chairman of the Planning Commission, Adam Strong. Good morning, Adam.
Good morning.
So, what are your takeaways from the walkabout? Do you think it was helpful?
Yeah, site visits usually are. And although that site visit was a little harder to get our heads around the size and scale of the buildings, just because looking at a stake in the ground and then being told that from the position of that stake and 35 feet in the air from there is the height of the building, it's a little hard to grasp that mentally. So the applicant, I think, is going to come back with a 3D computer model, which will give us a little bit more, a little bit better perception of what the scope and scale of the buildings are.
Now, if I recall, when there was a site visit like this years ago, they floated some balloons to show the height, and y'all didn't do that this time.
Well, they tried. I think the balloons, some elevated, some didn't. One popped, as I recall, and it was a long time ago. But, balloons are helpful. But, again, it's pretty hard to get your head around how big a building is, like the volume of a building, just by looking at a balloon floating in the air. So a 3D computer model is going to help us a little bit more, I think.
And were the citizens, the public who were there, did they ask some questions of Planning Commission or the developers? Was there a lot of discussion going on, or was it mostly just a presentation?
Yeah, and during site visits, there's not a lot of discussion, and that's for the, I think, good reason that it's not on the record. So none of the questions would be part of the record, and we want everything to be on the record, because if it's not on the record, as I've said before, it doesn't exist. So questions were asked, some were answered. All the questions were basically factual, such as where are we standing now, because all of the attendees were looking at maps, what number of stake is this, how high is this, that type of thing. No substantive questions about the project.
At the end of Wednesday's meeting, your advice to the developers was, don't bait us and don't taunt us. Why did you say that?
Well, you know, one of the biggest things that I am trying to do throughout this process is ensure that the applicant gets a fair hearing, because if and when this goes to a court, I do not want an argument made by the applicant that they got anything but a completely fair hearing. So I didn't want the applicant to taunt us by saying, you know, Commissioner Joyce, you said this and you attacked my credibility and you're just wrong, Commissioner Joyce. Or Commissioner Strawn, your calculation of the density is completely off. Commissioner Strawn, you're wrong. That type of thing can sometimes draw out more abrasive comments from commissioners who may feel they're being personally attacked. And before you know it, you've got a big argument, finger-pointing and shouting match, and that plays into the argument that the applicant didn't get a fair hearing. So I don't want the applicant to take that stance with us, because not only are we not going to take the bait, but I don't want them to ever argue they got anything but a fair hearing, because I think the record's very clear they're getting more than a fair hearing, more than due process. And it's not substantively helpful to the discussion. I mean, attacks about people being wrong or right aren't going to get us to where we need to be, and that is trying to figure out how to apply the CUP criteria and mitigate impacts.
So the central question still is, has Treasure shown they're entitled to over 1 million square feet on the side of this hill?
Well, we're a long way away from coming to that ultimate conclusion. We are still in the process of figuring out what the density allocation is. And from there, we have to take what I think is probably the most important step in the process, and that is applying the CUP criteria to determine what are the impacts and how are they going to be mitigated. And whatever the density allotment may be that we arrive at, that may be reduced or changed in some manner if mitigation of impacts requires it.
There still seems to be a debate on the 5% question. The staff says the support commercials vested for 5% of the hotel floor area.
Mm-hmm. Yep. There, I think there is some debate. The applicant certainly thinks there is. I think the commissioners in their heads are fairly clear that it is 5% of the hotel floor area, according to the 1985 Land Management Code, because that is the direction not only from staff after a very thorough analysis by Senior Planner Astorga and our own outside counsel, Jody Burnett. So I think we have a very strong basis for concluding that that 5% is the right number.
The developers have also asked for a work session before the next public hearing. Will the city do this? And if so, when will it take place?
I think we will. It's going to take place soon. At least that was the direction we gave staff. And the purpose of that work session is to look at that 3D model that I mentioned earlier and figure out, just try to get our heads around the size and scale and really the positioning and the location of the buildings and, almost equally importantly, the excavation that would have to occur to put those buildings where the applicant wants to place them. So that is a work session so that we can kind of ask questions of the developer as we look at the 3D model. Hey, what's this over here? Where does that go? How high is that? That type of thing, rather than the formal process that we've had in the meetings in the past. And I should add, public is invited and encouraged to attend that work session, and public comment will be taken.
And when that 3D model becomes available, is it possible for the public to see that before that work session? How can we get that out there and let people know where to go and where they can see it?
Well, I don't know if it will be available before the work session. That's up to the applicant. I certainly hope they make it publicly available, and I told them to make it publicly available. They, of course, don't have to do exactly what I tell them, but if they want to maintain their position of keeping their project like an open book and totally transparent, then I think they should give it to the public before the meeting, and I think it should remain in the public domain afterwards, so that commissioners like Commissioner Phillips, who has experience dealing with 3D models with the SketchUp program, can look at it and analyze it and turn it around and do some analysis on it, you know, on his own, and members of the public should be able to do the same thing.
Well, we will wait to hear more on that. This is Park City Planning Commission Chairman Adam Strawn. Thank you for being here this morning. Welcome back to the Local News Hour. It is 8:21. Well, it's an election year, and in about 1 month, October 18th, ballots will start showing up in mailboxes in Utah. The congressional representative for Summit County, Republican Rob Bishop, is running for reelection. He joins us on the phone this morning. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I hope I have you there.
Yep. Can you hear me okay?
Okay. Yes, good.
Good. Thanks for calling in. Let's start with the Public Lands Initiative. It had its first hearing in Congress this week. The Natural Resources Subcommittee didn't vote on the matter, however. How do you think the hearing went?
I was actually very pleased with the hearing. As I emphasized, it was not the hearing or even the first hearing. We've been having hearings on this bill for the last 3 years, and we've had it all over the state. We've also had it online so that people could add comments. So I think it was just the continuation of the kind of transparency we've been trying to have in the process. And I was actually very pleased. I was pleased with the testimony that was given by the witnesses. I was pleased by the questions. There are some I didn't ever expect to be positive about it, but they didn't say anything new or different, or most of the stuff was actually misinformation. So I'm looking even more positive about the chance of actually passing this thing in this year than I ever was before.
Well, the head of the Bureau of Land Management testified that this is problematic, and he's not aware of a precedent where the state's been given primacy over energy development. He says that you're going to give the state the power to streamline the permits for the extraction business. Is that true?
No, he's wrong. Once again, he's wrong. We're not doing anything different than has been done. DEQ obviously has primacy over certain areas with respect to the federal government, but this would not. What we're doing in our bill would simply say that once the leases have been identified using BLM standards and BLM procedure, the paperwork would be done by the state of Utah. States can do the paperwork in 30 days or less, whereas it takes the federal government like 300 days on at the best, sometimes multiple years, just to do the paperwork. So we're not giving primacy over to the state. That's an inaccurate statement on the part of Neil Cornsey. All we're doing is allowing the paperwork to be done by the state because they are more competent and they can do it faster. It doesn't change the standards, doesn't change the lease process, doesn't change anything except for the actual paperwork that's done. So when he said that, I called him on it because it was inaccurate.
Your opponent here for House District 1, Dr. Peter Clemens, said that the Public Lands Initiative has virtually no chance of passing Congress. He also said the Native American tribes walked away from the table a year ago because they didn't feel like they were being listened to. But you still have some Native Americans on your side with PLI.
Yeah, we do. Those who came up with, especially in San Juan County, Utah Native Americans in San Juan County, they're the ones that came up with our proposal on how to deal with Bears Ears and what would be north of that in a ranch that's owned by the Nature Conservancy. They are still very much opposed to a national monument, and they're very much in favor of it. If you find some of the tribes that are outside of the state of Utah, those are the only ones that actually are kind of weighing in on the side of a monument. The rest are very positive, and the Commissioner Manali's testimony was extremely strong and very positive about the fact that this, that what we are doing in the PLI gives them the flexibility to continue on with their traditions, their sacred rights, And it gives it the flexibility to do it in the way they want to, because we have written that into the language. A monument cannot do that.
Well, you're adamantly against the monument, and you've told the Secretary of the Department of the Interior, Sally Jewell, that if the Obama administration creates a national monument at Bears Ears, it would be unprecedented because nobody in the Utah delegation supports it. There's not even a state legislator from that area who supports it or commissioner from that area that supports it. But your critics say the land doesn't belong solely to those people. It's federal land. It was always federal land. And a citizen in Ohio has as much right to say what can happen there as a resident of Summit County. What's your response to that?
That's an oversimplification which doesn't work in reality. In the real world, if everyone owns it, basically no one owns it, and it's up to the land manager, who may or may not be following the law or may or may not be arbitrary decisions. And that's what we're trying to get away from. What I'm trying to do with PLM is simply say, we will define what the land is, what the primary purpose of each parcel of land will be, And then we will put in the restrictions, the requirements, what we expect the land managers to do. That's the way it should have been done from the very beginning. Part of the problem that we have is for the last 90 years, Congress has been writing really vague laws with language like, you know, the secretary shall promulgate rules and regulations. That's where the problem has been. That's one of the things that BLM objected to, that we're taking away their statutory, their flexibility, as they say it. But what we're trying to do is say, this time of arbitrary changes in how you manage the land has to go. And it is congressional responsibility to state how the practices will be maintained. And that's exactly what we are attempting to do with this.
Your opponents say you're taking money from the oil and gas industries, that it's the bulk of the donations to your office, and it comes from out of state, that influences your legislation. How do you respond to that?
Well, no. Like, I hate fundraising. I'm an anemic fundraiser. If you look at the members of Congress, I'm always the bottom of those who raise money. Even our delegation, I've always been the bottom of those raising money. I am raising about the same amount of money from my district that I have always raised every cycle. It is, though, this year that I'm getting, as chairman of the committee, I'm getting a significant amount, a lot of money from outside the state of Utah. But what we're raising from within the state is pretty much consistent with what I've always done and what I'm always doing. And that's the reality. You can play games with the numbers, but that's basically what is occurring.
Switching topics to Mountain Accord, we're following some breaking news here. Last night's Park City Council meeting, Councilman Andy Bierman, who represents this area on the Mountain Accord, he told his colleagues that there had been a setback with the Accord's efforts to preserve 80,000 acres in the Wasatch Central Mountains. Your colleague, Congressman Jason Chaffetz, introduced a bill that would create a national conservation and recreation area. Here's what Councilman Bierman had to say.
The one update I have for you guys, and this isn't a good update, but we've been told that the 900 acres that are in Summit County, known as the Monitor Bowls, has been pulled out of this protections. My understanding is Representative Bishop has pulled those out personally, and the only conclusion, Vail was in opposition to those, and they didn't want to happen. So it's on this side of the ridge line, but it's only Forest Service land on our side. It's land that the Forest Service has deemed not suitable for a resort expansion, and they've told the resorts that, but Vail has, they've objected to that, and that's part of why they left the Accord, is because they felt like it was limiting their future possibilities.
Congressman Bishop, is that right? Did you remove 900 acres from that protection?
No, I don't even know where that land is, but it's not my bill. It's not actually had a hearing in my committee yet. It's not to the point where I could actually pull something out. If I remember roughly about what he's, if I remember right, the conversations we've had, I think I understand the area he's talking about, and it may be problematic, but that is not the key issue. This accord was scheduled to have a hearing. If we don't go into this last week of September, that may have to be pushed back in some point. But it is, I haven't pulled anything out. It's not my bill.
Have you had any conversations with ski resort representatives, Vail, or any other resort about that area?
Personally, not that I recall. My staff may have, and I'm assuming the committee staff will, because that's part and parcel of what they do as they prepare bills for the hearings. But I don't recall personally having one.
Moving on to the election, you've been in office since 2002. We have a new dynamic with this year's election. That's mail-in voting. People are getting their ballots in mid-October, about a month from now. How does that change your campaign strategy?
Well, this is such a new phenomenon that I don't think anyone knows exactly how that changes strategies for anybody. It used to be, the concept was you would have an election date, and there would be a snapshot in time of what people were thinking on that date. Now you're having an election month, and this is a more complicated approach to it. I think in the future, maybe candidates will try and spend more time early on campaigning or putting up signs, doing commercials, that kind of stuff. I think that's a negative. I wish it wasn't any earlier than the process that it already is. But I don't know. I think people have got to see how this plays out, and it's going to be an evolutionary process of how candidates react to this. I'm sorry.
So it sounds like you're on the fence as to whether you think mail-in voting is a good thing or a bad thing.
No. You asked me how candidates react to it, and I think that's still to be determined. Anything we can do to actually encourage voting and make it better, I think, would be helpful. I do realize, what happened to Mel Brown, that if people are going to do mail-in voting, they have to be very careful to make sure that they get their ballots in very quickly on time, so there is not a controversy as to when the postmark was or how long it took for it to be postmarked from the time it was mailed. People also, as they were mail-in voting, have got to take some responsibility in making sure that they do this very in a timely fashion, so you don't have those type of hiccups.
Congressman Bishop, thank you for your time. Is there anything else you want our listeners to hear from you?
Oh, there's a whole bunch. I've got all sorts of soapboxes out there. I think you've hit on some of them. But anytime that you have other questions, please, I'd be more than happy to speak with you and or to your listeners.
Thank you, Congressman. Welcome back to the Local News Hour. The time is 8:34. Park City Council met last night. On the agenda, the future of Library Field. Councilwoman Cindy Matsumoto joins me in studio this morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
So let's talk about Library Fields. I understand there was quite a contingent there.
There was. It was great to have the public out because, we really respect public opinion and really want it. So this citizens group has been very active, and they were coming to hear the report from COSAC that was recommending that a third-party preservation easement be put on the property.
And a third-party preservation, that sounds a little scary to some people who want the city to say, we want this preserved permanently as open space, the city to own it, zone it as such, so there can never be a question.
Well, actually, the third-party preservation would be the strongest thing we could put on there. And those citizens that were there, I believe, were there to support the COSAC's recommendation of a third-party easement. That way the city cannot step in and do things because we permanently preserved it in the terms that are described in the easement, which there is no such easement right now.
Got it. So can you help our listeners understand how putting this land in the hands of a third party, it would be like Summit Land Conservancy. Give us an example of what a third party would be.
Well, those are the two that have been used in our community, Utah Lands and Summit Lands. And those parties, they monitor the land. They watch for the any encroachment on the easements. If it's such that there's, typically like there's no hunting on, there's no motorized vehicles. That's on some of our large, open space lands. They look for people doing things there that they shouldn't be doing. And there would be a completely different easement on this field because we want people to be doing things on it. There are events on it that we want to be able to continue. So this wouldn't be a conservation easement, but a preservation easement, which would be no one thing that we agreed upon was that there would be no permanent structure that was habitable.
The proponents of preservation seem to feel some urgency about putting a mechanism on the field, putting something in place. What's your take? Do you think this is an urgent matter?
Well, you know, it's something we've been discussing for a while. And, you know, the citizens that were there, they had 350-odd signatures, a petition. We've had lots of emails. It seems like there's a lot of public support for some type of preservation. And it can be done in a different way. And that's what the, you know, there's lots of lots of support for some kind of preservation, and I do think that we should try to get it done as soon as we can, since the otherwise people just think we're delaying and have some alternative motive, and I just want to say we don't. We do want to go forward with some kind of preservation, and we want to look at all kinds of vehicles, of not just a preservation easement that was recommended by COSAC, but zoning or something that was used in the first corridor preservation had to be a 5-person vote on the city council or a 4-person vote on the city council, and then go to the citizenship for a 60% vote. So that was one tool that could be used. So we want to bring together COSAC and the Recreation Board and figure out what the best would be to use on that property.
So the action out of last night's meeting was council directing COSAC and staff to study the issue over the next 6 months and then bring something back to you guys.
Yes, hopefully they'll bring something back before 6 months so that we can have another public discussion about whether this is the correct, whatever is recommended is the correct one. And it was also to look at our broader parks, if they need any preservation, and can't remember it was also that we do not want permanent structures.
An interesting discussion on the Special Events Advisory Committee. This is a relatively new committee with the city. I think the committee has been in place since January 2015. It's a committee made of different stakeholders in the community. They look at the big events that are coming to town, like the Kimball Arts Festival, the Tour of Utah, the Autumn Aloft that's happening right now. There was a resolution to add Summit County and Park City School District to the SEAC committee, but another item came up, a concern, because the committee has 7 members who represent local businesses or resort interests, but only 4 people from the general public. Cindy, do you think that's out of balance?
Well, there was discussion, so I'm here to represent the council's view, and there was a lot of discussion that we really wanted to have the citizens' feedback. And so the council recommended that we talk to them next. They're coming next to our next meeting, and we want to have a robust discussion about increasing the citizen involvement and increasing the frequency of the meetings so that we can make more progress on this issue.
And you talked about the process they go through to decide the events that they drop from the city calendar. Do you think we have too many events, not enough?
Well, once again, we want to hear from the citizens about this. And they haven't perfected the matrix that they're using yet, but you have to try it out to make sure, something that's very beloved, like, I don't know, because everybody has different issues, but if someone, loved the Halloween parade or something like that, and you do this matrix and it comes at the very bottom and you says, okay, it's at the bottom, get rid of it. Well, we don't want to get rid of that, maybe we want to mitigate it, maybe we want to limit it or something, but we don't want to get rid of it. But you really have to try your matrix, see what your results are, and then see if you getting what you want. And so this is not going to be an easy matrix situation, because 80% of our events are put on by our nonprofits. And of the remaining 20%, maybe 15% of those, maybe 90% of those, or 80, a large percent of those contribute to nonprofits. So when you talk about getting rid of some event, you're saying we're taking the funding mechanism away from our nonprofit, which is Well, that's hard to do. So I think we want to listen to the citizens. We want to add citizens to the board. And it's just going to be a long process. And we really want the involvement of the greater community also. We had a special meeting before the first week of September, the 6th or something of September. We had a SEAC meeting. And they are open to the public. And we had public speak. And so we hope that as they go forward, we will have more public people, at-large people on the committee, and that we'll also hear from the greater community.
The council voted last night to partially waive city fees for the Park City Shot Ski event, which is being done by a nonprofit, the Sunrise Rotary, and a business, Wasatch Brew Pub. The council exempted the fees except for police fees. Nan Worrell dissented, feeling it should get a complete exemption, which is given to Park City Rotary for 4th of July festivities. Why did you vote the way you did on that?
Well, once again, I'm here to represent the council views today, and the council voted to exempt the fees except for the $25,000
would be a lot. Yeah,
$25,000 would be. I think it's $2,500 fees for the police. And the reason that I heard other council people express and was that we can't keep accepting all fees, even though it's for nonprofits. Because, you know, we certainly appreciate the good work that the Sunrise Rotary does. And, you know, but our police department is being asked more and more for demands. And we are going to have to, the city council believes that we're going to have more of a review of what we can exempt for even the nonprofits in the police department, because we're just running out of funds. And you know, we either have to increase the budget, which means we have to decrease it someplace else. And so it's going to be – so we took a stand last night and asked that the police fees be paid.
On another issue on the agenda, there was no comment in the scheduled public hearing about the $25 million bond that will be on the ballot this year to possibly buy Bonanza Flats. In past city council meetings, you did hear from citizens who stepped up in support of this. Why do you think no one showed up last night?
Well, this is really just a procedural. We have to have these hearings. And, you know, people, you know, I'm not sure, but they might be aware of the issues. They might be aware of the pros and the cons. And but by state mandate, we are required to have these meetings, and they're just not might not be people feel the urgency just to fulfill a requirement.
And then at the very end of the meeting, Andy Bierman disclosed that the Mountain Accord is in some jeopardy. At least the 900 acres of the Mountain Accord that were set aside for conservation. These are 900 acres in Summit County that cover the Monitor Bowl area. Bierman said that his understanding is Congressman Bishop pulled the 900 acres out. We just interviewed Bishop, and he said that's not true. What was your reaction to what Councilman Bierman said last night?
Well, as a council, we are supportive of Summit County's position to save those acres in Summit County. So we are disappointed as a council that those aren't there, and we support the Summit County's whatever the Summit County wants to do.
Anything else you want to add from last night's meeting?
Well, I think that several of our council members, Nan Worrell and Andy, you know, really expressed the heartbreak of our community over losing two wonderful young people. And it's very sad. And we are heartbroken. It's just all that I can say that we are. And we offer our condolences and have these people in our hearts. And we want just to say that, you know, we appreciate all the support that the schools and the city staff and the police have done. And just, you know, we hope that we can help the people get through this, you know, very trying, sad time.
Park City Councilwoman Cindy Matsumoto, thank you for being with us this morning.
Thank you.
Welcome back to KPCW. You're listening to The local news hour, I'm Renee Bodley, filling in for Leslie Thatcher. Sting's Broadway show, The Last Ship, opens tonight at the Pioneer Theater. That's at the University of Utah campus. The Grammy-winning rock star talked to me about why he chose Utah audiences to be the first to see his work after it left the Great White Way. Sting says the environment he grew up in, the shipbuilding town of Wall's End in northern England, was surreal. Generations of families worked in the shipyard, and the hulking ships at the end of the streets blocked the sun.
I didn't want to work in the shipyard myself. It was a terrifying place. It was either that or work in a coal mine, so I figured I had to escape, and music became my avenue of escape.
That escape took Sting on a path to rock and roll success, first with the Police from 1977 to 1984, and then a solo career, winning 16 Grammy Awards, a Golden Globe, an Emmy, and 3 Academy Award nominations for Best Original Song. After achieving commercial and artistic success, Sting heard the call of home.
I always recognize how important that environment was in terms of who I am, why I am like I am, why I behave the way I do, why I think the way I do. So I wanted to go back there and really pay tribute to the community I come from.
So he wrote The Last Ship, a Broadway musical that opened in 2014 and lasted only 4 months, closing January 2015. But Sting took an unusual step of retaining the rights to the show, according to Karen Eisenberg, the artistic director of Pioneer Theater. That meant she could work directly with his representatives to bring the production to Utah, the play's first stop after Broadway. Eisenberg will also be the director and choreographer of the show.
Last Ship is definitely fresh and new, and not very many people will have had the opportunity to see it. But it also is a unique opportunity because the rights to this show are not generally available. So at this moment in time, we are the only theater in the country who has the rights to do this show.
Sting says the idea for the play began when he started writing a list of people he knew from home.
Just names and what they did in the shipyard and what their hopes and their fears and their ambitions were. And from that, we conjured up a story, a love story, a story of alienation, a story of coming home, a story of finding yourself back in your community and how you can help that community.
And those stories cover themes he thinks will appeal to audiences in Utah.
It's a play about work, the importance of work, the pride of work, the importance of community, and family. And I think those issues are very, very universal. I think the people of Salt Lake City will get them, will appreciate them, and recognize in their own community, in their own work, something that resonates with them, too.
Eisenberg agrees.
One of the reasons I felt that we were a good place to do this show again is that I think those themes will resonate with this audience in a really strong way, and that it might help find the heart and soul a little further of the play.
The production's appeal extends beyond Utah. Eisenberg said many New York Broadway veterans wanted to be a part of it.
Folks from New York who know about the kind of work we do, and when they heard we were doing Last Ship, were like, please, can I audition? Please, can I be involved? Which was also incredibly exciting. So we had a turnout in New York that I kind of haven't seen since Les Mis. That was exciting. And that was another thing that said to me, people are intrigued by this show. They think this story has some teeth and they want to be a part of it.
And she thinks you should be a part of it, too.
I don't think you should miss this one. There's an excitement around I sort of haven't felt that I think everybody wants to be a part of. So come see this.
Sting says he will come to the show. So if you go, you may want to keep an eye out for him in the audience.
I'm extremely excited to come and visit and see the play, which I know will be different to the one we did on Broadway, because Karen has asked if she can adapt in some ways. We've said we'd love to see what she does because we want to learn something. So it'll be as much as a surprise to me as anybody else. So I'm very excited, and I can't wait.
That was Sting talking about his play, The Last Ship, that's going to be starting tonight at the Pioneer Theater down at the University of Utah. If you're interested in getting tickets for that, they range from $44 to $60. You can go to pioneertheater.org to get tickets. That's Pioneer Theater, and theater spelled with an R-E, the English way, .org. Local news time is 8:52. It's Family Meal Month, and the Summit Community Gardens in Eats Park City are hosting a dinner to celebrate. EATS stands for Eat Awesome Things at School. Joining me to talk about the event are Ken Kulak with the Gardens and Ann Bloomquist with EATS. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Thank you for being here. Hey, Ken, let's start with you.
Sure.
How's the garden this year?
It's doing awesome. We have a lot of plot renters this year. We had a goal of originally 60 plot renters, and we're up to over almost 90. And the garden looks great. You know, we have a garden staff that's really keeping it well-maintained, and you have to give credit to the plot renters themselves as well, the volunteers. I mean, we've had so much community support with the garden itself. It's becoming a destination for the community, and it really looks great.
Remind our listeners where that is.
It's on the address is 4056 Shadow Mountain Drive, but it's basically across from Matt Canute Park, right along 224.
Right there by the Winter Sports School.
Correct.
Well,
correct.
How did you accommodate the 90 instead of 60? From what I can tell walking by, it didn't grow. I mean, it's growing up, but it didn't grow out.
Yeah, that's a great question. We had planned to have a little bit of excess area as part of the garden. It's basically a circular design, and within that circle, we had different beds allocated to different gardens or projects, and basically we had repurposed some of that other area for some of our other gardens to go towards plot renters. You know, our goal as an organization really is to reconnect people with the food that they eat and help them think about growing their own food and help educating them on how they could do that within this high desert climate, which can be a challenge at times. So we feel the garden is designed to do that, and one of our goals was to make sure that if there are people who want to grow their own food, we give them the opportunity to do so.
And if people are interested in signing up for this next year, just remind us how much it costs and about when should they be looking to sign up?
Sure. We're gonna open it up pretty soon. Right now we have a waiting list, but basically it's $50 for the season. It's a 4x16 plot. And basically, we provide drip irrigation, which is very efficient. So all you really need to do is if you start seed or what have you, if you want to hand water, we also provide hoses and watering cans. So really, at $50, it's a really great value for people who are coming in. Right now, our waiting list is about 10 or 12 for next year. What we're going to do is we're going to basically open it back up, give our existing plot renters the first choice to decide to renew. And then probably like right around October or November, we're going to basically cut it off and say, okay, now we're going to open it up to the rest of the public. So it's hard to say how many we're going to have, but we know that we have a lot of enthusiastic renters right now.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Yeah.
And Eat Awesome Things at School, trying to get kids to eat healthy at school. How's the school year been for your program so far?
Oh, it's been a fantastic year. We're so excited. You know, we worked with the Park City School District last year, and we challenged them to do something about improving school food this year, and they rose to the occasion. We're so happy. They came up with a program they're calling 15 to Clean, where they're taking out unnecessary ingredients and moving towards more made-from-scratch food. They are working with local restaurants and using their recipes and coming up with 18 new menu items this school year. And this week, I'm happy to announce that we introduced our very first one, or I should say they introduced it, in the Adventure Bites program. And they used Deer Valley's lasagna recipe, but it was made by all the Child Nutrition Services staff in the schools. And it was fantastic. And so Eats' role in that was we were conducting the taste test with the kids on Wednesday in all seven schools, and the first time we've done it in the high school, which was fantastic, and I was there for that one. And the kids loved it. They loved the fact that it was a Deer Valley recipe that made mm-hmm. them help make them try it. And then when they tried, they were blown away, and it was made right here in our kitchens. And that's the type of food that we can and will have in our school system. So the premise then was the kids actually got to vote on an iPads Whether or not they liked the food and whether or not they want it on the line. So the kids are going to be in charge of whether or not these new recipes come into the school food system or not.
Who pays for this? How much does this cost?
The school system within the Child Nutrition Services Department, this isn't going to cost us any more than buying a processed lasagna or anything. It's going to be more labor intensive, but the ingredients are cheaper. So there's some management within that.
So do you need to bring in more kitchen staff? Did the schools have to hire more people to make this food?
Not yet, but I think that's something that we're going to be looking at. Here, with 18 new recipe items coming, it's a management of when that lasagna was made. So it was made a few days prior and frozen so that they could work it into their cooking schedule. And so it really is a logistics and a management thing as far as that goes. But then I also want to mention that today, so we'll take that same recipe, and today we have our cooking class at McPolin, and those kids in the after-school program will actually make that same recipe today, and they'll make the Deer Valley recipe lasagna. And so they'll see what's in it. And one of the key ingredients in it is zucchini. There was no pasta in it. It was gluten-free. And the noodles was the zucchini. And the kids were blown away by that. So we are so pleased with what the turn has happened with the school district and where the school food's going.
I know you guys have a lot of good information for our families out there about how to eat healthy and the benefits of eating dinner together as a family. The first thing I think we should let them know is you're here to talk about an event that you're hosting tomorrow night that's already sold out, but that doesn't mean that people can't participate in other ways.
Yeah, and it's not tomorrow night. It's Sunday.
Sunday night.
Sunday afternoon from 3 to 6 in the afternoon.
Correct.
At the community gardens. And it's a true partnership in many, many ways that Summit Community Gardens and Eats has come together because we have very similar missions on wanting to teach people about eating local, healthy food. But it's also a partnership, and the people who are supplying the food is Deer Valley and Park City Mountain. They're coming together. You know, most events, it's either one or the other. Here, it's both of them coming together to make the food, mostly coming from local sources right there in the garden or Copper Moose Farms or other places.
Yeah. We're supplying some of the produce from the garden that's grown by our own very own garden staff. We're getting some donations from other organizations. It really is. This event is really about bringing the community together. And it's not just about the family meal. It's about the community gathering and getting to know each other. We have a little icebreaker questions at each table where people are going to basically answer from their own perspective, you know, when was the last time I ate a local ingredient? When was the last time that we sat down as a family and ate a meal together? And then also list the person who's sitting next to you that you haven't met before and what's their favorite vegetable. So the idea is to bring people together and enjoy a great meal.
And you'll do this again next year.
That's the plan.
That's the plan. So, yeah, get on the waiting list this year so we know how many people out there want to come for next year.
Good advice. Thank you. Ken Kulak with Summit Community Gardens and Ann Bloomquist with Eat Awesome Things at School. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
KPCW News Time is 9 o'clock.